As you may know, I practice a profession for which there is no real name. What I have been doing for 40 years is practice the psychology of individual freedom. It's my job to corrupt young people with the contagious, infectious idea of individual freedom. It's my job to encourage you and to empower you to think for yourself, question authorities.
This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 133. I'm your host, Jan Urban. This episode is an interview with Gino Denning, Part 4, titled Beyond the Trivium, and is being released on Sunday, January 8, 2012. My interview with Gene was recorded on Saturday, January 7, 2012. And Happy New Year, everyone. We've made it to 2012, and Terrence McKenna's end date of the world is upon us, or just around the corner, or so we're told to believe. But today I've got someone very special for you, and someone who will help you see through all of the BS. And today, for our episode 133, the long-awaited Gino Denning is back to teach us about what lies beyond the trivium, and we'll be discussing the differences between Plato and Aristotelian philosophy, as well as teaching the trivium to children. This is the continuation of the story of the three successive stages of the philosophic life, which almost all of us live. Some of us live it consciously, others not so much. Gene's story is one of good fortune. Early in adolescence, he was given the tools to recognize and to pursue the philosophic life, which he undertook to do, not as a vocation, but as a serious hobbyist. This is part of what this talk is about, defining those tools and following time-tested ways of applying them. Gene lived through the first part, the stage of preparing for life, in a fashion which the ancient Vedic sages called learning by grazing through the fields of the Brahma, the creator god, in sobriety and with a guru. And he even had his own guru. He graduated from this stage in a less than sober state. At age 18, he ingested the Eucharist in fact, rather than only in effigy, and had his crown chakra opened. When he was 20 years old, he began the second stage, the stage of receiving from life. This is when he began his vocational career and started his family life. Life was good. He and his wife traveled many parts of the English-speaking world, scouring the libraries in particular, she reading her beloved fiction, and he in the reference and Aquarian sections. His quest was to find out what money was. Money is a very elusive thing. As ghostly as it is, it takes up much of our life's time and energy. By happenstance and pursuit of its secrets, almost all other known topics come into view for a closer examination, including philosophy, a treasure beyond measure. As he reached the age of about 56, he had the realization that he was now in the final stage, the stage of giving back to life. This is when one should properly become the elder advisor, not offering advice, but giving of it freely when asked. It is also the time of beginning one's journey through mentality. This is the time of, quote, examining a life which has been worth living, end quote, as the Greek sage Socrates counseled. And upcoming shows, it looks like Clint Richardson will be back, possibly with Brett Vinod of the School Sucks podcast, and I'm not sure who after that. I still haven't heard anything back from Denise Menger from Raw Food SOS, so I suppose we'll cancel that one. And let's see, Dr. Stanislav Brzezinski is lined up for some time in February, but I'm not sure who's going to be on after Clint. And donations, this episode is dedicated to Randy, Paul, Brian, Michael, Derek, Christopher, Kim, Valerie, Tad, Max, Janet, David, Joseph, Kathleen, Patrick, John, Jean, Aaron, Donald, Jason, Andreas, Angela, Samuel, Lewis, and Lewis, two separate Lewises, two separate spellings, and John and Bew. And thanks so much to all of you, and this episode is going to make all of your donations well worthwhile. And we still need more equipment purchases and are seeking donations for a monitor, for three more hard drives. I was able to get one of them, and a new microphone. And we put a widget up on the website to encourage people to donate for a new book and DVD project I've been working on for the last several years. It's going to be basically a biography on Wasson and a lot of information that I've discovered over the last several years regarding his background and the foundations of the psychedelic movement, especially surrounding magic mushrooms. And the title of that is going to be, or at least the DVD aspect will be, something to the effect of The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms. And so I've got a lot of information that is not found anywhere else that will be going into that for the world to see, so we can use your help. And again, the widget is on the front page of the Gnostic Media website if you would like to help contribute to that. And people who donate $50 or more, I will include a credit in the film for their donation, so I appreciate that. And this show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or a DVD or the She-Hura Members audio archives or the archives for this show, a t-shirt, etc., you help to continue this unprogramming. And of course, we greatly appreciate your support. And again, the first 3 years of the Gnostic Media podcast are finally up on the store page of the website for those of you who would like to order a copy of that. And that's about 210 hours of audio. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can check out the website at GnosticMedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com. You can contact me directly via the contact form on the website or at contact@GnosticMedia.com. And thank you for listening, and thank you for your support. And here is the long-awaited interview, part 4, on philosophy and more on the trivium with Gino Denning. Enjoy. Gino Denning, it's been a little over 2 years since you were here last, and we did a three-part series that has been the single most popular series that I've ever had on my show, and you are constantly the number one guest referred to by people who email me and contact me on a regular basis regarding the trivium and what we're going to be discussing today, which will be going beyond the trivium today. But I wanted to welcome you back to the Gnostic Media Podcast for your fourth appearance. And you know, let me just put it this way. In the last 2 years, two plus years since you were on, the ability for my brain to see through nonsense and the rate at which I think now compared to how I was, how I thought before, and how I'm able to analyze data and information and all of, you know, anything coming in via the five senses is phenomenally increased and more efficient or precise than it was over 2 years ago. So I wanted to thank you for that and welcome you back to the Gnostic Media Podcast.
Well, thank you for the welcome, and let me say what a pleasure it is to be back. And it's good to hear your comments about the clarity and consistency of mind that is starting to make itself known to you, because that is exactly the point. The last couple of years, it's the meme of the liberal arts and the trivium, mostly from your efforts, I think is really starting to take hold. And I've heard that comment about people being surprised that they look back and see a clarity that they hadn't had before, mostly from adults. They say that they study a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and after sleeping on it for a year, year and a half, all of a sudden they just one day without realizing it are becoming more consistent in their thoughts. The amount of data that they're able to process and to validate and to find truth within seems to become more apparent to them. The one thing that hasn't occurred yet, I haven't had it articulated to me, mostly from people that listen to our first three shows, interviews, 2 years ago, is they haven't started yet to notice the increase in self-confidence. Now, because I was
I gotta interrupt you on that one, because I would say, you know, maybe none of us had mentioned it to you, but I have noticed a significant increase. And not only that, but I can see when I teach it to other people, their increase in self-confidence. And it's something that I've pointed out to others on a regular basis, that how, as they learn this stuff, it increases their self-confidence. So I apologize for all of us for not saying anything to you in the last 2 years about that. So, yes, it's happening across the board in a major way.
Well, actually, I brought that point up not fishing for compliments, but actually to say that
I know you weren't fishing for it. I just thought I would give one there anyway.
Well, okay. Accepted. But that was the one thing, because I was presented with this material as a child and adolescent, I really didn't notice the clarity and consistency that was coming about. But I did notice the increase in self-confidence, and I didn't know why. I just thought it was a feature of you know, reaching your young adulthood or the latter stages of your adolescence. But as I think back on it now, my self-esteem was just given a boost that was very, very apparent to me. As I say, the clarity and so forth was not so much. But as adults have started to have their neural connections and their synaptic, the neural pathways open and their synaptic connections increase, it's just like studying music. You don't know why you're doing the scales at first. But at some point, you can get into the melody and the harmony of the situation, and if you study intently, you can even start to compose. But it's exactly the same thing. It's just building up your mental muscle, so to speak. It's not really muscle. It's neurology. But there is a physiological correlation, and as I say, self-confidence is not something that you can simply claim. One day you just say, well, I'm more self-confident than I was yesterday. It's a result, as is the features that you just mentioned, this clarity of thought, this ability to process data. You don't claim it. It is a result of studying, of making explicit what you already know implicitly as to how your mind works. And that's really what the trivium is. It's really just a description of the how our mind works. And today we're going to go to the step beyond the trivium and discuss some of the things as to what we should think about, or what attitudes and views we should take. We're going beyond the first step of the trivium. Once we learn how to walk, at some point we don't have to think about putting one foot in front of the other while remaining balanced anymore. We can walk, we can start to jog, we can start to run without thinking about it. So today we'll start going into the applications of the trivium. Of course, we've already covered some of the applications as regarding the world of matter, our first steps into looking at existence or reality, the features of reality through the quadrivium, the art and science of mind, the art and science of matter, which is those things that exist extended in space, whereas the trivium, the art and science of mind, had to do with complete abstractions. Our thoughts don't exist extended in space. They exist as abstractions in our mind. So I've noticed over the last couple of years that there have been some folks that are resistant to this idea of making explicit the how of the way the mind works. They think that it's a prescription as to how people should think about their own mental process, and it's really a description. What I've noticed with those who are resistant toward it, who look upon the trivium almost as a religion in some ways, that this is what you should believe in, and I am the authority that's telling you this, or that you, Jan, are the authority, and so on and so forth. But it's like being an infant, learning to walk, which I just alluded to, taking that first step. And the trivium is the first step. Without taking the trivium, it's like being an infant, getting ready to take that first step in walking, and pulling your foot back and deciding, no, I don't want to take the first step, but I will take the second step. Again, you can't take the second step without taking the first step. And that's the mental equivalent of walking. You don't want to take the step into logic until you've taken the first step into grammar, and then the third step into rhetoric, and on until it's internalized, until... I think the term that I used when we first presented our shows 2 years ago was that you make this the default method of your thinking. And the method just simply refers to your own personal awareness of this being explicit to you rather than its remaining implicit. So... let's go on and go into the step beyond the trivium, which are the subjects that are not concerned with how our mind works and thinks, but the subjects about what to think about, what we should use as guides in life, what we should develop as a group of beings that are cognizant, conscious human beings. What do we think about? And really, there have been three modes that mankind has developed, and it's just coincidental that it happens to be three at this point. I think we might go on to more, but a lot of people have likened this to something concerning numerology. Well, the three steps in the trivium and the three modes of the way we've developed our way in expressing what to think about. But it's coincidental. As I say, I think we'll go beyond that at some point. But the first mode, the first of the three modes of thought, which were developed chronologically, is the mode of mythology. And mythology is really analogical thinking, or making comparisons. You see one thing and you that's not quite familiar to you, and you compare it to something else. And this is how you attempt to bring understanding to it. Now, most of these comparisons in mythology evolved as time went on into anthropological comparisons, or stories about people. These stories were put together as a mythological story to explain beyond your own person, your own being, and your own generation, so that understanding would make its way forward through coming generations. But these stories would take things and phenomena in reality and personify them. And of course, this is where the stories of the gods and the spirits and whatever came about to try to explain things in our purview that was right in front of us. How do we teach not only our children, but as I mentioned, the generations to come? How do we build upon this? Well, of course, the advancement of mythology was to add to the story, to add to the complexity of the story as the complexity of understanding was realized. As we understood more and more, the stories would become more complex, and other anthropological entities, other gods and beings or spirits that had more or less human form, or the forms of animals and plants that we saw around us, came in to attempt to understand natural phenomena. Now, as we'll see in more modern times, we've come to use other systems of symbols, like number. And we've developed some more modern mythology that are non-anthropomorphic, that use, words and number to explain something that we have come to realize in more modern days. And it's the third mode, which I'll mention in just a moment. But our focus for today mostly is the second mode, which is philosophy. And this is where we make the tie-in, almost a direct tie-in, into the trivium, because philosophy, rather than being, like mythology, an analogical mode of thinking, is a logical mode of thinking. Rather than making comparisons to other things or people, this is making observation directly, observing the nature of the thing itself, and bringing understanding by finding consistencies within the process of our studies. We're not making up stories now. We're making, we're composing observations. Where if we're writing it, or in the oral tradition, if we're trying to explain it, we're now doing away with extraneous beings and motivations of those beings, and looking at the thing itself. And the way we come to understand it is seeing the consistency within the thing itself and its nature and its process of being. And another way of stating this is we're putting together a body of information, a body of study, by eliminating the contradictions that we encounter, either in our own observation or in our own understanding. But by eliminating the contradictions, which of course is the function of logic, of understanding, we come to know the thing in itself, and we don't have to rely on a narrative story, which is essentially a philosophy. A mythology. So philosophy can have its story added to as more is known, as the rules of logic essentially are applied to our observations, to eliminate, to take in more and more data, as you mentioned earlier, and to eliminate the contradictions within it. And that's what brings us into a consistent body of knowledge. As we build this consistency of knowledge, our own person becomes more consistent. Our own thoughts become more consistent. So this is encountered in the love of wisdom. Rhetoric, the third branch of the trivium, is really the expression and use of the first two, knowledge and understanding, as wisdom. So philosophy is this study of wisdom. And then the third level, which we have developed, the third mode of knowing what to think, is the latest development. And the latest legitimate, and I must specify this, legitimate mode is the scientific. And in order to add legitimacy to this, I'll more accurately call it the scientific method mode of study, which uses physical demonstration of phenomenon. This is the method which uses repeatable experimentation to demonstrate phenomena. The successful completion of a number of experiments to bring about understanding, and we can now make a statement of explanation, or what has come to be called a scientific theory. And a theory is a statement which recognizes that through observation of these completed cycles of experiments, we have a sufficient body of knowledge to say that this is what we know definitively up to this time. But as more knowledge is encountered in the future, there may be a possibility that we'll have to add to this statement of theory or to restate it. Unlike the mythological, when the story was completed, there was no room for argumentation. A priest class usually arose around it, or an authority class usually arose around it, and there was no room for argumentation. There was only room for compliance. Compliance to the authority who was the keeper of the mythology. And so this is actually a more humble statement, this idea of theory, of a scientific theory, than is the definitive narrative of a mythology. So now anyone who has five senses and has the ability to think can go out and design an experiment. And if the design goes to completion, if the goal is met, it means that it is true. It is objectively true. It does work in the material world. We have used the abstractions of our mind, which have no extension in space, to understand that which does have extension in space and demonstrated it through experiment. And through the rhetoric that was developed, or the rules of rhetoric that were developed in philosophy, are able to be explained in this theory of the scientific theory of the completed experiment. So let's go back to philosophy now, which again is our focus, and we'll use the example of Western philosophy. And in the 6th century BC, the Greek thinker Pythagoras was asked if he was a wise man, if he had, of course they didn't use these words, but he was asked if he had studied the trivium enough to consider himself a wise man. And he says, "No, I am not a wise man, but I love wisdom." So he described himself as a lover of wisdom. And in Greek, philein means love, and sophia means wisdom. So philosophy is derived from those two words in Greek. And he's the one that that mentioned in his time, in the wisdom that he had attained, that in human perspective, all that is matter and mind. All there is existence and awareness of existence, or consciousness. So we go forward a few years to Plato, about 100 years after Pythagoras had learned or put together his system, after learning this idea of philosophy from one of his predecessors, Thales of Miletus. Thales was a Greek who put together the Milesian school. And the revolutionary thing at that time was, again, not to try to bring understanding through making comparisons to things that were already understood, but by studying the thing itself and making a consistent observation of its being and its behavior. But Thales had not quite made the statement that all there is matter and mind. So he hadn't quite gotten to the point, nor had the students in his school, his successors, quite come to the revolutionary statement that Pythagoras made, the revolutionary induction, if you will, that matter and mind is all that there is in human perspective. So another Pythagorean thinker that I was getting ready to mention, and I had to digress back to Thales so we could make a complete story of this, was Plato, who in the 4th and 3rd century probably started the first university, and I'll get into what the academy that he founded actually was. But Plato was essentially a Pythagorean thinker, and he's noted for actually putting together the system, explicating or making explicit the system which was implicitly already being utilized and in existence for the 300 or 400 years prior to his time, to Plato's time. And he said that to systematize this way of thinking about the thing itself, he was going to use a method of asking and answering 4 questions, and thus systematize this love of wisdom through these 4 questions and answers. And I'm getting ready to explain those. I'm getting ready to name those 4 branches of philosophy, and I'll give the technical name along with what it basically means. But the first question and answer is called metaphysics. And this is really the basic question and answer of what is? What is everything? What's all around us? What are we? What is our purpose? The basic question, metaphysics, what is? The second question, the technical name for it is epistemology. And that has to do with what is really everything that is material and mental, everything that is within the purview of humanity. Epistemology is more focused. The question it asks is, how do we know? How do we know what is? So this is more skewed in the direction of mind. How do we know through our mind? Through what senses do we know? How do we connect with that which is? Which, of course, are the 5 senses. But how do we use abstraction to describe concrete existence? So this is epistemology. How do we know what is? And, of course, at the time of the Greeks, they were concerned with gathering a civil society around them as opposed to the existence of a tribal type of social arrangement. So what they called a polity was the gathering of various people from various tribes and various parts of the world, people that were involved in as merchants and so on and so forth, could come together and not be a member of the clan or the tribe and meet with and meet peacefully in a peaceable way with people who didn't necessarily share our basic values. But the third branch of philosophy has to do with how do you bring this about? Or once we know how we think, speak, or once we know what is, or we have an inkling of what is, we come from different tribes and different clans, but we know that we live in this environment. And we know that we are humans who think in a basically similar manner. So once we have an inkling of what is and how we know what is, how do we think, speak, and act to our advantage and to the people around us in a polity? And so this is the branch called ethics. And there are two subcategories in ethics, which is individual ethics, or how does one think, speak, and act advantageously toward oneself, the people who are that we're in closest contact with, our friends, our family, acquaintances, and associates, and toward our surroundings, our environment. So this is individual ethics. And then there's civil ethics. Once we are gathered in a polity, we are engaged in civil behavior. How do we act as groups of people amongst one another? And in Greece, being that they formed cities and called them polities, this was actually called political ethics. And of course, in modern usage, anything having to do with politics is almost the antithesis of proper action, speech, and behavior. It's more in our connotation having to do with deception. But this was the original usage of the word political, was the advantageous and decent treatment of one another. So this is these are the two sub-branches of ethics. Well, once we know what is, how we know what is, or have an inkling of what is, how we know what is, and how do we act advantageously, how do we communicate in a more complete form these ideas of what is, how we know, how do we think, speak, and act to the greatest advantage? So this is the fourth branch of philosophy, according to Plato's system, and it's called aesthetics. So aesthetics were means of explaining or making attempts at explaining the first three branches. And by the time of Plato, the fine arts had really been refined, and these were the interpretive arts. There were seven of them that were within the system of aesthetics itself. And the seven fine arts are the visual arts, which is sculpture, fine painting, and architecture. And the three performing arts, which are music, dance, and drama. And the conceptual art of poetry, or more broadly, literature. So those are the seven fine arts with which we express what we know, how we know, and how we act. So you can see a very close correlation to the trivium here, which of course was the description was developed before the description of philosophy. But metaphysics and epistemology is really grammar, the observation of what is, the initial way of organizing this mode of thinking. And ethics is the expression of what we understand, or the elimination of contradictions, the elimination of how we go about living our lives. And of course, aesthetics is rhetoric, or the expression of what we have learned. So now we have completed the system that Plato has put together, and one of his students, his most brilliant student, in fact, who spent 20 years at Plato's first university, the Academy, decided that Plato's interpretations were a little bit too idealistic. He brought his interpretation from philosophy of other dimensions as being more realistic than the one that we live in. So Plato's philosophy, as he expounded it, was that there was a world beyond ours, which was the real world, the world of forms, and that this is just the shadowy world that is less than real. Now, it's because he was at this juncture in time that he brought his academy together to use the gathering of knowledge without the benefit of entheogens or psychedelics, because the mystery schools, which were the repository of knowledge up to this time, the repository of mythology, used the interpretation of these psychedelic excursions in expressing knowledge. And this is where comparisons started to be made. And of course, Plato's world of forms was the more perfect form of a rock, that there was a realm in which rockness or woodness or whatever we see is idealized. So his philosophy was called idealism. And then Aristotle comes along, and without using strictly intellectual means, without benefit, as I say, of the utilization of psychoactives, he says we can use our intellect and our five senses to just explain what is in front of us. Plato was still in that realm between mythology and philosophy, or what philosophy has come to be developed in its fullest form by Aristotle. And Aristotle says, let's just do away with all of those extraneous things that you're talking about, including the world of forms, and just concentrate on knowing about the surroundings that we come in contact with our five senses, which of course is the material realm. All that is, according to Pythagoras, is mind and matter. So Aristotle is concerned with material existence. So his philosophy comes to be known as the materialistic philosophy, materialism. And this again, is not our modern usage of materialism, which is the idea of consumerism, to use consumer goods as the reference for materialism, or looking to possess material goods as materialism. This is just materialistic philosophy. Let's use this mode of thinking to explain the material world, the universe around us, and our own mind, which is part of it. So let's go through these terms a little bit more in depth and a little bit more quickly here. We'll return to metaphysics, which the modern philosopher and author Ayn Rand called one of the rubber terms, that metaphysics has come to mean many things to many people, just as in our first series of shows we went into the meaning of liberal, you and I, quite a bit. And that was another rubber term. It can be updated to mean anything at any time. But metaphysics was actually named by another philosopher who lived in the first century, and he was editing the works of Aristotle. And some of the written works of Aristotle included what they call physica, or the study of the physical world, his physics. And he came to this idea of the logical progression of how to answer what is, what Aristotle had put in his publication called the Organon, or the Instrument of Knowledge. And so he was editing this work right after he edited the physics. And one of the interpretations of meta in Greek is after. So Andronicus simply labeled this what Aristotle had called first philosophy, Andronicus called metaphysics, that which came after physics. And again, there are many meanings to meta, as well as metaphysics today, but there's enough background as to the reasoning that Andronicus mentioned as to why he called it metaphysics. I think first philosophy is much more apt. I can identify with that term easier than I can metaphysics, but that's only because this metaphysics, as I said, has become a rubber term. And the second technical description, epistemology, has two etymologies. And the reason I'm going into this, into this background, is when you're giving these technical terms, they can be used in many different senses. And if you just understand that these technical terms relate to one another in the way that I just meant, what is, how do we know what is, what do, and how do we explain? Those are the four branches in English, essentially. But epistemology has a couple of different etymologies, and one of them is taking the word episteme, which in Greek means the mental process of planning, and it's usually contrasted to techne, or technology, to making, or the plan for making. So episteme is really the gathering of the plan, and techne is the plan itself. And of course, in modern times, we have the idea of technology, which is making the thing, the manufactured item, from the techne, from the plan of the techne. And of course, logo in epistemology is the study of, in this usage. So it's the study of knowledge, essentially. Now there's another etymology which may help to clarify this as well, and that's to take the Greek word pistis, which means faith in Greek, and the prefix epistis means other than. So epistemology, the study of other than faith, actually refers to what can be known through other than faith, or faith in authority. So we're already starting to get to the idea that authority, an authority outside oneself, does not need to be consulted if first the trivium is internalized, becomes the default method of thinking, and this particular system of looking at the thing itself, finding consistencies, eliminating contradictions, will bring an individual to greater knowledge, to more advanced knowledge. So then we come up to, I'd already said we're circling a little bit further back toward the trivium, mentioning it again. And I'll try to explain where education came from. I think it's a Latin term. It's educere, or educere, and it means to draw out. So we're now in philosophy. We still need to draw our inferences of what we learn in philosophy out. So we have to develop discernment or judgment in order to draw out what has been suggested by aesthetics. This is really where we interpret what is meant in the painting, or interpret the sculpture, the architecture, what was said in the drama. What is the dance? What does the music relate to? We still must draw it out. Of course, when we get to the conceptual level, it's a little bit more explicit in poetry and in literature, but we still have not gotten to the point of science where we're a witness to the completed cycle of an experiment doesn't have to draw out up to that point, but there's still a recognition that in the future more data may be processed and we will have to change the statement of the theory. But this idea of education, of getting us to the state where we can draw our own conclusions out, is what's missing from modern schooling. What is missing from modern schooling? Education is missing. The education that gives us the ability to accurately judge or discern. So that's where we are right now in the middle ground of philosophy, which is what we can all learn without instrumentation. There's no instrumentality in developing a philosophy or following a philosophy. And what most of us, once we understand a type of philosophy or the theory of philosophy, we want to, because of the branch of aesthetics, know how to advantageously think and act. We want to have this ability to judge. And so that would be called a practical philosophy rather than a theoretical philosophy. Plato's philosophy, for example, was largely theoretical, whereas Aristotle tried to bring about a way of thinking and acting in the real world that could be applied. So that would be a practical philosophy. And at some point, after we understand the theory of philosophy, we can endeavor to either follow or to develop our own personal philosophy, to live practically, to live the 70, 80, 90 years of our lives advantageously with ourselves and with our fellows. And it's that idea of ethical thought and behavior that we should strive toward. So are there any comments or questions you have up to this point, Jan?
Why don't we start off with, how did you first come across the trivium, and when did you first come across the word trivium?
Well, you're going back to the concern with these people who don't want to look into the idea. And I think it's instructional to tell the story that I have to tell, which was that I was taught grammar essentially by my mother at age 9, and it was something that I could internalize, that the things that we call nouns, verbs, adjectives, and prepositional phrases actually had to do with things in reality. And she would point out a house and a dog and so forth to indicate that in fact those are nouns, and I got a relationship. And this is really what grammar is all about. What is your relationship to things in reality and within your consciousness? And these are the ways that you describe them. If you want to communicate, if you want to think deeply about something, you actually need language. You don't think that you do, but you have an internal conversation. This internal conversation starts up at the age of puberty, when the two lateral halves of the brain actually start to separate their connection. Up to that point, they're connected in series, so to speak, and they're a storehouse of data. Now, data is undifferentiated points of reference, either to matter, the real world, or to abstractions, the mental world. And when you reach puberty, you start getting this internal dialogue. You start asking more pointed questions, and the pointed questions are really about, how do I understand this data that I've already internalized, or how do I understand incoming data as it's occurring? And of course, this is logic. And when I was 13, I just by happenstance started up with my family dentist as a preceptor, learning the back office procedures of actually making the artificial teeth and appliances, which are more time consuming than the clinical dentistry. But unbeknownst to me, he almost immediately started me off by copying a dictionary, a desk dictionary. And I had no idea what this had to do with with learning dentistry. But like you, and this is only in retrospect, after a couple of months of doing this, I started to see a bit more clarity in thought. Now, at that time, I didn't express it like that, but things seemed to come easier to me. His explanations became easier. And rather than explaining things to me directly, he started to give me books, and he called them grammar books. Now, if you look at these books yourself, if you're not familiar with the specialty of dentistry, you'd think that head and neck anatomy and the description of those and the interconnections or the study of dental materials, the crystalline forms versus amorphous solids and so on and so forth is fairly advanced. But that's why he had me copy out of the dictionary so that I could start to take in broader, so that I could start to expand my mind through these connections that were being made, these neural pathways that were being increased by simply doing copy work, copying out of the dictionary. And he completed the grammar, or got me to start understanding the grammar of dentistry, the grammar books, as he was explaining it to me, so that he wouldn't have to continue to essentially lecture. But as he was presenting this, as he was presenting the general grammar or the nomenclature, the very specialized nomenclature of dentistry, I started to understand what these meant and how they interconnected, how dental materials had to do with head and neck anatomy or a specific feature of head and neck anatomy. So I was bringing understanding to this. And when I'd have a question, or when he saw that I didn't quite have the understanding, what he was detecting were the contradictions that I had within my understanding. Eliminate the contradiction and the holistic concept of dentistry started to make itself known to me. So this was logic being given me. And at some point, when I was about 14 or 15, I started to explain. He would ask me to explain how I was going to proceed on this next case. It was a complex case. And I was using the general grammar. I was using the idea of a general grammar, but I was using the special grammar of dental nomenclature to give my explanation in terms of rhetoric. I was explaining to him what my knowledge and understanding was. By the time I was 17 or 18, I think he explicitly said that this is what this was. This was the grammar, logic, and rhetoric of dentistry that I was assuming here. Now, I also found out, and John Gatto actually goes into this. John Taylor Gatto, in a lot of his publications, says, find someone who is in the field that you're interested in and build up a relationship. Well, of course, Gatto's publications weren't around at the time that I was going to school, but this was actually part of a school assignment when I was age 13, was to do exactly that, to go out and interview people. And this is how I came into contact to work in this man's office. To me, it was work. But it was really, he was giving me an education. But he explained to me at age 16 or 17, I can't remember, I was a senior in high school, I believe, when he explicitly said, these are the three disciplines of the mind. And then he explained that there are four other disciplines that are all grouped together as the seven liberal arts. And the other disciplines, which all had to do with number itself, number in space, number in time, number in space and time, were the four arts and sciences of matter. So I was being given the first three of the seven liberal arts as the arts and science of mind. And he explained, essentially just briefly went over the four arts and sciences of matter. And mind and matter, again going back to Pythagoras, is all that is in human perspective. So my terminology was that of the seven liberal arts, the first three and the second four. And it wasn't until I had already started up my family and professional career, and I was age 33, and my wife and I went to New Zealand for an extended trip. And this, again, was on the suggestion of this mentor that I had when I was an adolescent. He said, go to New Zealand. They had a dental school at that time that I could have attended. I subsequently decided not to go into clinical dentistry but stay in the laboratory field. And I didn't need any further education for this. I just started to develop a business. But when we went, as I say, at age 33 to New Zealand, one of the things that my mentor had mentioned is to go to the small towns in New Zealand. And he says, you'll find that New Zealand, you will perceive to be seemingly 30 or 40 years behind the way the culture and society is developed here in America. Of course, there are English speakers in New Zealand. New Zealand is about 1,500 miles off the coast of Australia in the southern hemisphere, but they're essentially both settled. The European settlement there is from the British Isles. So everything was in English, and we traveled from one small town to the other. And he says, go into the libraries, and you'll get a completely different education. Now, to my knowledge, my mentor had never been to the southern hemisphere, or to New Zealand or Australia, and yet he knew that there was quite a treasure, particularly in the antiquarian section, the old book section of these small libraries, because they didn't go through the books like they do here, and clean out the old publications to make room for the new. So I found that to be quite something. But one of the things that occurred was, my wife is a fan of literary mysteries. She was a big Agatha Christie fan. And another contemporary of Agatha Christie in England was an author named Dorothy L. Sayers. And of course, from our first series of shows, people are familiar with this, because she wrote a very influential essay in 1947 called The Lost Tools of Learning. But because we were in New Zealand, we were getting a lot of British television over there. And one of the dramatizations was of Dorothy Sayers' mystery character. She had a series of mysteries. And the character in there was named Lord Peter Wimsey. And he was a noble character in the English countryside that would solve these various crimes and murders, a la the characters that Agatha Christie had. So my wife was familiar with this woman. And I went to the library at one of the larger towns there in New Zealand and just started to inquire about Dorothy Sayers, because I knew her I knew her through my wife as a mystery writer, but I also heard that she had done translation of Dante's Divine Comedy, and she really considered that her life's work, was that translation. So I just went up to the library and asked to see some of her, if she could direct me to some of her more scholarly work. And the librarian just started to volunteer that she had been an instructor at Oxford University, and that she'd written an influential treatise, an essay on education. So she directed me over to this Lost Tools of Learning, and of course that was the first time I had ever come in contact with the term trivium, which is Latin for where three roads meet. But I had, once I read the essay, of course I knew that she was referring to the first three of the seven liberal arts that I had been taught. And once I had that idea of this trivium, and of course quadrivium, I was directly led to Sister Miriam Joseph's book, who was an American professor at an all-girls college in the 1920s and 30s, I believe. But she put together a study plan, and this was essentially it, the book that has become known as the Trivium. And her greatest achievement, I think, and because it brought clarity to me, was her explanation of general grammar. It's within the first three chapters of her book. And already having some familiarity with logic and rhetoric, I could follow more or less what she was saying in her sections on logic and rhetoric. But her language is really Latinized English. It's really the terms that were updated to explain the trivium right around the time of St. Thomas Aquinas, after the first millennium in Christianity, and supposedly Aristotle's teachings had been lost, and they were still contained in the Mideast, in the Arabic language. And there was a couple of particular men that the followers of Thomas Aquinas translated into Latin. And this was the last update of the trivium into Latin. And this is one of the reasons that you'll run into the idea that the Christian religion has co-opted the trivium. And it's no more than a linguistic connection, because Latin was the language of the church at the time of Thomas Aquinas, 1,000 years ago, and or almost. And for that reason, it's called the Christian Trivium, because it was explained and updated in Latin. And Sister Miriam Joseph's technical terms are all, as I say, just Latinized English or the Latin terms themselves. So they're a little bit harder to follow. But having known what she was talking about, I could follow what she was saying. If you try to read the Trivium book by Sister Miriam Joseph linearly, you'll have a lot of difficulty in following it, as you've probably noticed by trying to do so. But this is really where I came upon the terms trivium and quadrivium. And that's why I'm still surprised at people when they refer to the trivium as almost this mystical prescription that's been downloaded from the heavens, you know, into somebody's head. And well, in fact, it has, into all of our heads. That is the way we think. But people can come to terms without using the word trivium if they find that offensive, by just studying the first three subjects of the seven liberal arts and sciences. And of course, we've gone through that discussion on the term liberal, which I mentioned in regard to metaphysics, is that these terms come to mean different things at different times. And liberal is simply the freeing of one's mind from the oppression, from his own oppression through ignorance, freeing the individual from his own ignorance or from the oppression brought about by his own ignorance. And that's the story of the Trivium as I came upon it.
All right, Gene, what have you learned since first coming on my show a little over 2 years ago about teaching the Trivium to others, especially adults?
Well, what have I learned in the last 2 years? I think I've learned more than possibly anyone else has. So we'd be here all day talking about that. But yeah, I have found that teaching the Trivium to children who can comprehend the idea of grammar before they reach adolescence, and then teaching logic and rhetoric. And I shouldn't really use the word teach. I should really say present, because I've never taught it. These are things that need to be realized. You can be taught certain subjects. You can be taught science, genuine science. But this has to be realized over time. And as we had already alluded to, you and I, that you have noticed these manifestations in your own thinking that have started to occur. This realization has started going to place. Excuse me. But I found that it takes everybody about usually a year and a half or 2 years of exposure to this material before it does start to make these impressions on the mind, on your own mind, through the results of more clarity in thought, more consistency in thought. And that regards both children and adults. The thing that I'm seeing with adults is what we've already spoken of a number of times today, which is this resistance to this label of the trivium, that it's some kind of philosophical school or religious school of thought or something like that, rather than simply being a description. But a child being introduced to the term and what they are has no preconceptions. He has no prejudice against it. So there's nothing for him to overcome. And because children and adolescents are in their formative stage of life as being mammals who have an extended childhood into adolescence, I call the end of childhood somewhere in the middle of adolescence, 15, 16. And there's no clear distinction other than this ability to start having an internal dialogue and also to have an external dialogue with the people around you to bring about this understanding, to eliminate contradictions within your understanding or the way knowledge is presented to you. Children can't do this. But on the other hand, they're not trying to analyze. They're not trying to bring their prejudices into the conversation of the trivium itself, as adults initially try to do. Because they're in this stage of learning, of being around their parents and their elders to be taught what they their elders have learned, it's just a matter of course. Learning grammar is just like learning their numbers. How to put numbers together and how to take numbers away, the addition and subtraction. So grammar is just a set of rules, and if you can, get them to have this relationship with grammar as it connects to reality. And then when you become an adolescent and you start asking these questions of yourself, the right side of your brain starts asking the left side of your brain certain questions and vice versa. And you have this internal dialogue start up. And of course, it's expressed to other people as you get around them. You want to bring this quality of understanding, of eliminating contradictions. But you're still in the learning mode. You still do not have prejudices. You don't have life experience to bring to it. So it's very natural for you to do this. And a lot of times, adolescents will concurrently, at the same time they're becoming familiar with logic, also become familiar in expression or rhetoric, which really has fewer rules. Grammar is fairly well developed, and it has the most prescriptive rules of the three subjects of the trivium. Logic itself, the four branches of logic, is really a set of suggestions, a series of hints as to how to proceed. And it develops judgment because you're making more connections within your brain as you make these studies. And rhetoric is really where the creative bit of thought starts to manifest, because you're now using your own knowledge and understanding in your own expression. So the rules of rhetoric as Dorothy Sayers in her essay says, can't really be systematized or haven't been systematized because a certain amount of freedom is needed for your own expression. So grammar really relates to the critical part of the trivium, which is logic. You're trying to eliminate contradictions. So you're being critical of things that you look at. But in rhetoric, this is where the idea of creative thinking comes in. So the trivium is the system of describing critical creative thinking. But as you progress through it, the prescriptions become looser and looser. Grammar has the greatest number of prescriptions. And that's why it's suited to prepubescent children. They have their brains wired in series, and they can memorize a lot of these things. And they can come to a basic understanding that these rules actually are rules of existence, are rules of life, not just of language. Language is a reflection of that which we encounter and think about. So they get that connection, but they don't really fully realize, they don't fully understand this until they enter puberty, which is one of the times in life when the body and the brain goes through a significant change. But childhood up to puberty, adolescence up to active adulthood around 20, 25, when you enter your reproductive stage of life, this is when you start your family and career active life. So there is a preparation of life, a period of preparation, and then your active life. Now, once you start your active life, you already have this penchant of wanting to take part in activity. And as you become active in family, in career, in other interests, you start building these prejudices if you don't have a method by which to be critical. So if you're introduced to the trivium for the first time as an adult, the first thing you have to do is make an effort to put your prejudice aside. But once you do, as you personally can attest to, and some of the people who have really connected with this can attest to, once you do, it takes you about a year, year and a half to build up this neural system. And you can proceed through your active stage of life. Now, it still takes a child and adolescent about a year, year and a half, 2 years, to build up this neural network, this neural system by which you can start to connect more and more dots. You start to have more and more choices. The reason it's easier for children is it's just part of their preparatory stage of life, their learning from their environment and from their elders, and of course from the literature that their elders have provided, if that literature is true. John Taylor Gatto, who just completed a project with the Tragedy and Hope project, mentioned so much of what's taught in school today is actually not true. It's fantasies. It's presented, it's claimed as being true, but it's not even true, especially as you start to get into secondary education. So to sum up, that's about how long it takes to build the neural pathways. This is about how long it takes to do the brain work, and then the brain work will take off on its own. But it's about a year, year and a half, 2 years. Whether you're an adult or a child, it's simply easier for children and adolescents to catch on because they don't have any prejudicial ideas to overcome.
Let's talk about teaching the trivium to children. That is probably one of the things that people write me asking for more information on the most. So what can we provide to give them some information on that?
After we did our shows 2 years ago, I mentioned that there was a, that I had a bibliography and resource list. And in that bibliography and resource list, one of the inclusions in that was that letter that I wrote to a writer of a book on primary and secondary education. And that was the letter that I sent to you in an email, which got your interest going. You had an idea that an implicit idea that these things existed, but you never knew how to succinctly summarize it. And you found that summary in that letter. So I included that letter that got your attention and explained in the resource list that Jan Ervin was initially attracted to this through this letter. And I think I may have provided a little bit too much in the way of resources and bibliography, because I essentially just included everything that I could think of in there. I think a number of people found it overwhelming. And so lately I've been prefacing that list and bibliography with a little warning to not let this overwhelm you. Just stick to the things that relate to the trivium in here. And even that was not enough of a caveat, evidently. So I did get some inquiries from parents with young children, and they wanted to know, even though they had no grasp of it, they had no specific grasp of what the liberal arts were about, they wanted to know how to get started or get their children started in it. And so I composed a little piece that related to brain science, which is what I've been talking about today, relating the trivium to something physiological rather than just psychological. And they seem to connect with that. And you've since published that on your Trivium education page, and it's under the Trivium for Parents and Adults. And you've edited that piece and cleaned it up a bit, and that's where I would send people to parents who are interested. And it's not just home educating or homeschooling parents that can do this. People who have children and adolescents in government schools can do this on the side. I mean, I can attest to that personally, because I was going to public or government school the entire time that I was being presented with these things. As I say, grammar was presented to me by my mother in 1 week. I didn't even know, I was in fourth grade and I really didn't know how to read, because I had all the childhood diseases when I was in first and second grade. And it wasn't until I was in fourth grade and had to stand up and read in front of the class that a teacher, bless her, I can't even remember who she was, called my mother in and says, "Your boy can't read." My mother says, I suspected that. She says, "Leave it to me." And of course, they were teaching what had been developed to teach deaf children how to read, which was to take in the entire picture of the word, memorize it, and that's how you would begin to read. Essentially the way ideograms, as in China or Japanese kanji, you memorize the ideogram and it either stands for an entire concept or it's a syllable of a concept. And so phonetics breaks down the smallest utterance that you can have, a phoneme, and breaks it down into the various consonants, which are utterances that break up the breath, or the vowels, which come straight from the diaphragm without being interrupted. So those are the basic phonemes. And so when you're given the code, the phonetic code, as my mother did when I was 9 years old, you can start to learn how to read, because you have essentially the code, which you hadn't been given if you were taught as were deaf children. Now, there was a reason to teach deaf children that way. They couldn't use phonics. But again, referring to John Taylor Gatto's work, the idea is not to teach children anymore. It's not to educate them. It's to domesticate them. So this is part of the domestication process, is to get you to learn up to a certain point and no more. Well, I went from essentially not being able to read at age 9 to becoming a very proficient reader by the end of that term, by the end of that year. And I think it was because it was such a sudden insight to me that I learned to read that I understood that this would open up this entire world of reading, you know, essentially bringing time and space into my purview through reading. And that was a realization that came to me after she got me to understand. I was complaining to her, well, now that I know how to read, I sure don't like this idea of learning all these rules of grammar, because they just mean nothing to me. So as I say, within 5 days, she got me to understand that these terms, these rules, actually were rules of thought, rules of thinking, how to put a sentence, a complete thought together. And that was another adventure. So off you go into adventure. Well, parents who are homeschooling can do this. They can also do it, as Dorothy Sayers suggests, is to study another language. Because when you study another language and you put the grammar together with it, you see that this is a tool, that grammar is a tool. When you're applying the study of grammar to your native language as a complete abstraction, it has no meaning to you. But when you start studying another language, or especially if you're introduced to a new language, rather than just having a second language that's spoken at home, but when you're studying a new language, and of course in the Western tradition, the language to learn is Latin, and possibly Greek, and you make a real connection with the use of grammar to learn that language. Now, if you're not studying another language, you can come to this relationship with grammar if you understand that it actually means something in your native tongue or in any other tongue, because as a child you know that other languages are spoken. But by making this connection to reality, that these rules and terms that are used actually have relationship to reality, rather so that you can learn about reality rather than learning another language. Either way, it works. Now, for people that have children in government school, they could still be taught grammar as it relates to reality and make an impression on the child. And now the child, rather than just seeing these as disconnected abstractions that have nothing to do with anything in the world, essentially, become excited. Their curiosity cannot be allowed to remain, because children are curious, as most of us know, and that's what's taken out in school. We reach this critical point in adolescence where we go through all of these body and brain changes. And this is another point, as was pointed out in the Prussian education system. Again, John Taylor Gatto goes into this quite a bit. There are a number of other sources which point out how the Prussian education system in the early 19th century devised this system for domestication, or really reinstituted it. If you study ancient Sparta, you'll see that the same techniques were used there if you contrast Sparta to Athens in the education of the ordinary youth. But you take this idea of educating people, of building their discernment and their judgment out of the curriculum, and when you reach this critical stage of adolescence, when this internal dialogue kicks off, you can arrest that. And that really is where school concentrates on arresting your development. The Prussian education system saw that one of the other critical points was to take you away from your mother between age 4 and 5, and you could arrest development at that point. You could start to bring conflict between your school or the authority of your school and the natural relationship with parents, mother and father. So you're already starting to inculcate this idea of the fallacy of the argument from authority. And then pubescence occurs. You arrest the internal dialogue by bringing about complexity that is not comprehended. And that's why one of the easiest ways to do this is to provide algebraic thinking right between the ages of 10, 12, 11, without it having anything to do with reality. It's just simply an abstract subject taught out of a book on the blackboard with no connection to reality whatsoever. And here you go with authority again. Well, this is much too difficult for me to understand. I know other people can understand it, but I can't. Therefore, I need an authority. Let's go home and flip on the television so I don't have to think anymore. Because now thinking becomes a chore, a task. It's not an adventure. When something is adventurous to a person at any age, curiosity is stimulated in a positive fashion. You're not trying to distance yourself from the chore of thinking about something to which you see no end. You don't see understanding coming about from that. And by just getting this idea of logic, formal logic, especially the rules of definition, that there is, and this really goes back to mythology. Philosophy was developed from mythology, which was to take something that you knew, which was a general term, and this new thing that is a part of that general term, but it has a difference. And this is just like thinking of logic as being either a body of knowledge which is totally coherent, there are no contradictions within it, or having a body of knowledge and removing the contradiction. Either way, you wind up with the same thing, which is erudition. You know the consistent subject. And by taking the difference within the general, you take a word, you put that word within a general category, like philosophy. It is a way of thinking. The general category would be a way of thinking. And what is the difference between this way of thinking and the other? It is a logical way of thinking rather than an analogical way of thinking. So that's the differential. Now, this again builds these neural pathways, these synaptic connections. You're going from the general back down here to the specific, the difference in the specific. This builds judgment. When you go to a dictionary to look for a dictionary definition or the lexical definition, it depends on when that dictionary was written as to what the definition is given as. Because that going to a dictionary does not necessarily give you what that term means. It just gives you the use of that term at this time. So it's really, a dictionary is really the use of a term at any particular time. So this exercise of going to definition, of finding the general term, liberal, the general term of liberal, form of freedom is the general term. Well, what does liberal or liberty mean? It means it is the release of the individual from the oppression of his own ignorance.
Well, listen to what Oxford has to say on that very subject, and it's interesting that you just mentioned that word because I happen to just have my true definition of liberal article up in my face when you said that. And the first definition in Oxford says, originally, the distinctive epithet of those arts or sciences, see Art 7, that were considered worthy of free man, opposed to servile or mechanical.
Yeah. But you see that they distinguished the individual man, whereas freedom, for example, and you might want to look that up in Oxford.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting point that you bring
that
up. Because
that's a group.
Right. People assume that they have freedom as the herd when in actuality they have to earn it or learn it through the seven liberal arts.
Well, that goes back to liberty again. The seven liberal arts are learned by the individual in a group. Now, liberty is freedom of oppression from your own ignorance. Freedom, and you see, here we are talking the lexical
right.
definition. Now, again, I came upon this from a, I don't even know the vintage of the dictionary in New Zealand, but it was an English dictionary. I don't know that it was Oxford, but it was an English dictionary which stated that freedom was the freedom of, was the release of a group of people from the oppression of force and fraud imposed by another group or individual of their own kind. So see, freedom is actually the release of oppression from force and fraud. As a liberal person, you have to be able to judge what force and especially
right.
fraud is.
And you have start to know all of the fallacies and be able to remove the contradictions and spot everything so that you can do that, so that you can have freedom from those predatory actions.
Yeah, you're discussing, whenever you discuss fallacies as being the central feature of logic, you're actually speaking of what has come to be known, and again, I got this when I was in my tour of New Zealand, you're actually speaking of what is called, in modern terms, informal logic. Informal
Correct.
Logic is essentially the study of the fallacies, which is the fallacies themselves are the result of using inductive, deductive, reasoning along with the rules of definition to come to those conclusions. So those are already conclusions that are used so...
Sure, and I just mentioned the fallacies because that's the easy thing to explain quickly rather than going into syllogisms and a lot of other...
Well, that's deductive reasoning. Yeah,
right.
We cannot. All we can do, as I've mentioned to many people, is sow seeds. We cannot teach or even present these things to people because it takes space repetition. It's really not as you may or may not know this, but a lot of people can come to this, as possibly you did, by just being exposed to it, by not actually having a focused study or trying to learn it. It's just being around it. And it starts to make inroads. And the reason these inroads are just these neural pathways starting to connect.
Well, I've definitely also probably read 15 or 20 books in relation to this stuff in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them that you recommended on Logic and the Trivium by Sister Miriam Joseph. And of course, many Quadrivium books and other goodies. And then also just a couple of weeks ago, we finished a very long logic study group with the Tragedy and Hope group with Richard and Lisa and the whole gang over there.
Well, I was in on the initial part of that, but I decided to draw back because this is where I was seeing some of the differentiation between adults studying this or being exposed to this as opposed to children. And here's another difference between adults and children. But I think you get to the same point. I noticed in the few sessions that I listened to that you were all trying to master one segment. You were trying to master deductive thinking. You were trying to master inductive thinking. You were trying to master term definition, rather than going through it, say, several times, because one is there is a synergy between the subjects. Often a question that you have will be answered in another part of the study, in another branch. But this is where children, again, and adolescents can get things in a different form. You present the original instruction. Well, I don't even, again, you present the three subjects essentially the first time out, and with an emphasis on term definition, because that's fairly easy. The most technical part, and is deduction. It's what deductive reasoning. It's all the rules that Aristotle came up with to manipulate declarative sentences or propositions. This is all often called propositional logic, deduction, or there's another term that doesn't come to mind. But that's truly difficult. And all that really does, unless you're an attorney trying to make your way through today's world of legalese, all that does is build neural pathways. You're never going to use that in the real world. Insights come to you once this is internalized without explanation. It's this automatic way of thinking after a while. Deduction is one of those things that you can exercise your way through. Induction is a description. Concentrating on the big picture, genera, in definition, concentrating on the big picture, the genus of a term, gives you the big picture. The differentia gives you the specialized picture. And so your mind gets used to working the relationship between the big picture and the little picture. So this is where the idea of making the connections comes from. And what you do is you go through these three branches in more and more detail. You go through an initial presentation to children. Then the second time you go through it, you spend more time. You really start to emphasize definition. The third time you go through, you spend a lot of time in deductive, in the exercises of deductive logic, rather than trying to master one at a time. It's this idea of spaced repetition. And this is why this has to be updated today for children. And there's a difference. Now, I can't say that your approach of trying to master, and I use that word trying advisedly because I don't know if you did or not, but the idea of trying to master each segment before going on to the next, it seems like a difficult way to go. But as long as the neural connections are made, fine. You know, that's the way to go.
Well, I think we're just trying to get understanding. But as far as, you know, how we laid out the logic class, it was actually just based per week on each disc in Leonard Peikoff's
yes.
Introduction to Logic and going through that. And then, mm-hmm. you know, we would answer people's questions and discuss the flaws in Peikoff's layout. And I think overall, because we did that, in the future, with all of the recordings that we have of that group, we'll be able to go through and lay out a very well-structured course, weeding out all the garbage and recognizing the many weaknesses in Peikoff's stuff. As good as it is, it's he obviously has many weaknesses, one of them being that he loves to come to conclusions about things before he's actually researched and done his grammar on it. So, but
well, he's trying to promote a philosophy, the philosophy of
right,
Ayn Rand.
Absolutely. And yeah. What we've found is that by using his work and then Peter Kreeft's work, and who's Christian, ironically, Peter Kreeft is, and then a couple of other people's logic books, we were able to kind of go through, because, you know, in many areas, Peikoff likes to make things overly complicated so that he sounds really intelligent, whereas Peter Kreeft will break it down really simply. And what's funny is Peter Kreeft uses all of these fallacious explanations in his book relating it to Christianity and his own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, not killing the messenger and taking the meat out of each of these guys that's valid, we were able to come to a lot better understanding of this material. And so I think, you know, eventually if we go through and transcribe all of that stuff and possibly take the good stuff out, it would be, you know, worthy of publication, or at least using it to help others learn this type of material.
Peter Kreeft, I'm not familiar with, but I do know that, as you and I have discussed on a number of occasions, this has to be presented without an agenda attached to it, just in neutral terms.
Exactly. And they all have their agenda that you and I have talked about before,
yeah.
even Sister Miriam Joseph's book on the Trivium.
Sure.
And, you know, all of this stuff needs to be redone without an objectivist Ayn Randian, agenda, or without a Christian agenda, or any of these others that these people put in. And you know, they don't want to present it just, you know, give me the facts, Jack. That all of them dress it in their own stuff, you know, and it's just, how about just lay it all out and give me the facts of this information and not put your personal twist into it.
Well, a lot of times you can't avoid, because one of the ways to teach abstract subjects is you must include case studies. You must include examples. And whenever you start getting into examples, some of these things creep in. But one of the members of your group, the group that you're just referring to, discovered that one of the books that Peikoff himself mentions, An Introduction to Logic, or Logic and Introduction, by Lionel Ruby, has gone into print. And I subsequently, because she said she could discern, this member of your group could discern that Peikoff may have gotten his outline from Lionel Ruby. So I got the book, and sure enough, I mean, I see very little agenda other than just having to come make some suggestions in there that you can't get away from, you know, some biases, some political and psychological biases that have to come up within the presentation of case studies. But it's not complex per se, the book, but I think it's a little too heavy. It goes into a little bit too much, too many examples.
Which book
much,
is that again?
Lionel Ruby.
Okay, yeah, I do have that one. Okay, uh-huh. And that's another one that we used as well for the logic study group. And so we use these three primarily, the Peikoff, the Kreeft, and then the Ruby.
Well, Kreeft I'm going to have to look into, because as I say, I'm completely unfamiliar with his work. The other group, the Christian group, of course, is the one that I'm familiar with.
You're talking about Harvey Bluedorn.
The Bluedorn family, yeah.
And, of course, they've got their own Christian agenda in that material. You know, and it's they still put out good material, but
absolutely.
Eventually we need to go and put together a series of books on all of this stuff. But I do have Socratic Logic by Peter Kreeft up on the study materials page on the Trivium website, because we were using it so extensively.
Okay, I'll have to look into that. Good.
And so that was, you know, it provided on some difficult points where Peikoff almost deliberately overcomplicated things, Kreeft comes through and just makes them really simple and easy to grasp and understand. So,
that was my own understanding between Sister Miriam Joseph and Peikoff.
Gotcha.
Now I came across Peikoff's here's where I saw the difference when I came across Peikoff's lectures in the mid-1970s. I think he recorded those in 72 or 73. But I came across it, and the thing that stuck out in my mind in Peikoff's lecture is that he presents the logical fallacies first, and he actually says in his lecture that this is the way it's normally presented in college courses, and it may be. I audited a logic course in college just to get the logical fallacies, because these were not emphasized to me by my mentor. We only got into a couple of them. But I thought that this is a way to make it interesting to adults, because I was taught exactly, they were toward the end of the presentation of logic. But by presenting the logical fallacies first, adults are brought into intrigue, wanting to know
right. How
this was brought out.
Exactly.
So
I think it's because they get immediate application and gratification there. They
right. Can
say, aha, uh-huh. Oh, wow, I could use this.
You know? Absolutely. And I think that's a valid way to go. But there's another difference between adults who gravitate to informal. If left to their own devices, they gravitate to informal logic. And children, who, if you just present it to them, they really get the most benefit out of the study of definition, which really is, as I say, the big picture, the little picture, is really the combination of deductive, the really hard technical part of deductive logic as expressed by Aristotle. And the rules of deductive logic, and really the suggestions for inductive logic, because you can't really set up specified rules for the big picture because we don't know it all yet, you know. I think Peikoff's explanation of induction, his introduction in his lectures to induction, is excellent, because he distinguishes what the ancients understanding was, that there was induction by complete enumeration, that you could generalize if you knew every instance of every entity, action, relationship, and attribute that is, was, or ever will be, which is impossible. You have to know everything before knowing anything in that. And then he explains that there's such a thing called genuine induction, which is to see a number of instances and then make a general statement. And this is where the scientific method or science came up with the idea of theory. Is this is what we know up to now. We've seen so many instances here. This is our general statement of theory, which is definitive up to this point in our knowledge, and we've demonstrated it. Look, over here, we've demonstrated it experimentally several times. It's repeatable. But we know that we've never completely enumerated everything, and our knowledge may be added to. So it was through this idea of the distinction between complete enumeration and genuine induction that the scientific method was given validity. And I think Peikoff does an excellent job in there of doing that. And again, you know, what could he do? He couldn't really inject any propaganda at that point. But overall, you know, Peikoff has been a valuable asset to me. And especially in this way of teaching to adults by starting with informal logic or the fallacies, My vision, just to throw it out there for what it's worth, is to put all four of these branches of logic into separate volumes or separate pieces of media so that they can be presented in any order. For example, you can start adolescence off with definition and then go to deduction, and that'll freeze their brain for a while, and then come down to the big picture or induction, and finally give them the logical fallacies, how you use the first three branches to get to the logical fallacies. Whereas, as we just mentioned, adults are drawn in by the logical fallacies because they can be applied immediately. And I've seen people that I have been involved with over many years, I mean for 30 years, who started with the logical fallacies and just very occasionally would pick up a book. Mostly it was Copy and Cohen's Introduction to Logic. And they have started to get over the years, as I say, you know, 10, 20 years later, start to understand the essence of term definition, deduction, and induction. But I think this is the way to approach it, so that you can present any one of the four branches in any order.
And one thing I wanted to add is that what we found while Richard Grove and Paul Verge and I were teaching people about the trivium and Tony, etc., is that one of the biggest problems that people were having getting into the study of the trivium was finding the time, and people didn't have the organizational skills. So I happened to have a copy of David Allen's Getting Things Done series that I had gotten 5 or 6 years ago, and I had tried to give it to Rich several times over the years, and I brought it up with him one more time, and I started studying it again myself, and I found it extremely helpful as a trivium-like method, because he bases it all on input, processing, and output, which is grammar, logic, and rhetoric.
Right and, out of the book, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right out of the book. And so, you know, we found that many, many people have gotten a lot of benefit by just starting to organize their daily lives a little bit around what David Allen suggests, and then get into all of the trivium studies, and then they have sort of already a working foundation that they can build off of in their daily life.
I, on your recommendation, I got the audio version of that book and listened to it, and I agree. It does present, particularly, I had a little bit of trouble going through the first part because it is the organization of your day-to-day activity. But toward the end of the book, he really explained the theory, as you just did.
Or the audio stuff, yeah. Well, you know, yeah. And I should point out that most people say that they don't like the book near as much as the audio series, especially toward the trivium stuff.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so so we only keep the audio version up there.
Well, in along the same line, you and I were talking before we started the recording, there's another book called On Intelligence by Jeff Hawkins, which essentially explains what I was referring to, the trivium, in physiological, in brain science ways of how the mind works, and contrasts it to how a computer works. And I was put on to that book by another book that was titled Your Brain at Work. And it's another coach very similar to the one that you were referring to from Australia. His name is David Rock. And he presents his coaching along this line as a play. He takes a family where both parents work and they have children in school, different age children, and presents what I was essentially mentioning to you, that you present the trivium, actually logic, in three different stages completely. First, as a review. Secondly, in more detail. And thirdly, in complete detail. And he provides that in his book called, as I say, Your Brain at Work by David Rock. And all of these people who do business and personal coaching are essentially taking the same track. Another person in your circle, Jarrett Sanchez, who has the Next Step podcast that he publishes on occasion, has also started, as you know, the Trivium Binder blogspot. And on his homepage, down toward the bottom, and again, this is another agenda that has to be dealt with, is an article by a Mason. And evidently these various Masonic organizations do have within their own ranks coaches, people who bring along someone who hasn't gone through the various hierarchical steps. But this fellow has an excellent article that's listed at the bottom of Jarrett's homepage, Trivium Binder. Down at the bottom, before you actually click on the link there, it says, "An interesting article from the world of Freemasonry, one of the major repositories of the liberal arts and sciences for centuries." And of course, we've all covered this within our groups numerous times, that there's a problem in keeping secrets. I just have to say there is a problem in keeping secrets, and of course, the Masonic organizations often, for reasons that they think they have to have, keep secrets. But
it keeps them in power.
I suppose that's it. But when you pull up the first, yeah, that's it. People who know this will stay in power until you understand what they understand, when you know what they know. And then you can become your own person rather than being a member of the herd. But I really followed this from the first couple of paragraphs that he has here. This Brother Coach N, I think his name is Nagy, but he calls himself Coach N, and he says, "Not many Masons know that the training of the Entered Apprentice and Fellow Crafts, which are the first two of the three basic degrees in Masonry, the training of the Entered Apprentice, the first one, and the second one, and Fellow Crafts is designed to transform their brains." Yeah, I know this might sound pretty scary, but it's true. What's even scarier, though, is that I was a Mason who didn't know this up until this year. What changed my understanding of this was asking a simple question. As a result of my asking this question, seeking the answer, and knocking on whatever door I could find, a flood of information was opened up to me that bordered upon overwhelm. And I really recommend this little essay that he wrote for those people who can better grasp that there is a physiological component to the liberal arts and beyond, philosophy, mythology, and science.
Gene, did you have anything to add before we conclude this part four of the Trivium series?
Nothing to add, just words of encouragement to people. I would, just through the course of our conversation today, recommend that people go to your Trivium Education website, whether you have children or not, if you're an adult, and read that part on the Trivium for parents and children. Just to encourage people to continue to look into this, if not study it, to keep it in their mind, to keep the meme going, which was the goal that you and I had a couple of years ago. And again, I've got to thank you for your for your diligent work in keeping the word going. And I don't mean to sound evangelical about it, but this is what we all need to claim our humanity, as I've said before. To be wise, to be educated, is to be human.
And, of course, you're not going to get away without answering the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview.
This interview. There is something beyond the trivium. The trivium is how your brain works so that you can go beyond to these things that we can study to enrich our lives, so that we can enrich our lives not only through study, but through the application of our own knowledge, understanding, and the use of that, which is expressed as wisdom. So I really have to repeat what I just repeated. Become an educated, wise human.
Very well said, Gene. Thank you so much for the direction to information that has made all of our lives so much more interesting and clear and free over the last couple years.
Well said, Jan. Thank you for that final thought.
You're welcome. Take care, Gene.
All right, you too, Jan.
Bye-bye.